Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. We're going to be talking about something that's got everybody buzzing. James Cameron's got a documentary coming out. This is the guy who found the Titanic. This is the guy who gave us not only the Titanic as an archaeological and scientific interest, but also the movie. So what do you do when he says he's found not only the tomb of Jesus Christ, but his bones as well? The Tomb of Jesus is the name of the documentary, and the tagline is, "One revelation could change everything." Dr. Paul Meyer joins us to discuss this for the next few minutes of Issues Etc. Dr. Meyer is a regular guest. He's professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, and he's author of several books, including A Skeleton in God's Closet and In the Fullness of Time. Dr. Meyer, welcome back.
Hello, John. How are you?
Doing very well. Thanks for your time, by the way.
Sure enough.
All right. How do you respond when someone walks up and says, "Hey, James Cameron found it. It's the tomb of Jesus, and there's Jesus and his wife and maybe some of their kids, and all the bones are intact"?
Well, basically, in terms of a soundbite, I simply call it more junk on Jesus. More junk loaded on the portrait of Jesus. You know, the Da Vinci Code wasn't enough. Now we got to bring in archaeology. It's almost a studied conspiracy, except I'm not a conspiracy happy type. But it's simply a fact that this discovery at Talpiot, it's south of Jerusalem, is 28 years old. I heard about it first back in 1980, and the BBC did a film on it in 1996. So there's nothing new here, and I just simply can't understand why the world hasn't heard about this. A combination of names that is totally coincidental, that has nothing to do with Jesus and his family, not at all. Jesus himself, the name Yeshua, shows up 21 times in Josephus in the New Testament alone. And this is only the famous Jesuses. Mary shows up. One out of four Jewish women at that time were called Maria. This is really unimpressive, and any scholar is pretty well scoffing at this. There are couples who say that, well, maybe there's some authenticity there, but there's really kind of a tempest in a teapot here. But it's sensational, of course, and this is what's, you know, driving the whole idea to sell the book, to sell the Discovery Channel thing on March 4th and so on.
All right. In terms of looking at this as an historian and someone with an interest in archaeology, Dr. Meyer, there are 10 ossuaries found, these bone boxes. Six of them seem to have familiar names, names that someone might associate with Jesus or Mary Magdalene or Mary or something along those lines.
Yeah, Mary Magdalene's name does not show up there. They're trying to turn one of the names into Mary Magdalene.
So is this simply a case of greatly mistaken identity?
It's a case of an authentic discovery. There's no question about that. You know, unlike everybody's comparing this to my novel, A Skeleton in God's Closet, because we have something similar here, and they're wondering if fact is following art here. So it's an authentic discovery. It's the interpretations of that discovery that are just off the wall.
When we look at the sites that are normally associated with the burial of Jesus, how would you rate the sepulcher site in Jerusalem there, the one that is most often associated with Jesus' burial and resurrection?
When Constantine, the first Christian emperor, converted and urged on by his dear pious mother Helena, he sent his engineers and his architects to interview the Christian bishop of Jerusalem at the time in 326. His name was Makarios. And he had no trouble telling exactly where Joseph's tomb had been. And so this is the site, not Talpiot. There is simply no indication why the rest of the family would ever want to have a family tomb in Judea or Jerusalem, the city that killed Jesus. This family came from Galilee. Joseph was buried up in Galilee. Mary went with John to Ephesus. That's clear from earliest church traditions, including Eusebius. And so what in the world is she doing now buried back in Jerusalem? The whole thing does not cohere with the rest of church history.
So many things would have to be falsified in the biblical record regarding not only Jesus, of course, but of his mother and of the other characters who were supposedly involved here.
Absolutely.
It really boggles the mind.
This is the whole point. All of a sudden, you claim to have fresh evidence, And here James Cameron, who knows nothing about archaeology, comes along and claims that this is all really very probably true and so on. And Simcha Jakubovici, I think is how he pronounced his name, is an opportunist of the first water. I don't know if you saw his documentary on the Exodus, but, you know, in that film it was really kind of pathetic. He proves everything that happened in the Bible, you know, the rivers turning to blood and all. He always has fancy-dancy explanations for all these things. Well, that's the kind of a guy he is. He's a wannabe Indiana Jones, and he isn't.
But they found the DNA. They cross-checked the DNA. What do you make of all this element of the...
Again, this is a popular tagline that people are going to run around and say, well, the DNA proves it's Jesus. Hello, how do we know what DNA Jesus had? And so all they did was compare the DNA between Jesus and this one woman named Mary Amene, not Maria, but Mary Amene, and they found there were different DNA. That's all the DNA found. And therefore different, they must have been married. You see, because the husband and wife have different DNA. That's the kind of crazy conclusions they're jumping to.
Would any archaeologist worth his salt, who simply comes across a find like this, would he feel justified in drawing any of these kind of conclusions, or even entertaining these things as something more than mere speculation?
No, because the thing was discovered back in 1980, and the archaeologists at the time just, you know, smiled and said coincidence, and that's all. It's these latter-day prophets who come along and are now trying to make a big fuss about it. This is an old thing. It's not a new thing. What's interesting to me is Joe Zia, who runs the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem. Now, here's a Jew, and most of the Jews of it, you know, this would be kind of a way by which they could derail Christianity if they wanted to. But all the Jewish scholars there just are they shake their head in dismay at the present furor because it's ridiculous. Josiah says this is just insanity to make conclusions like this. And they could have gone the other way, but they're honest.
Dr. Paul Meyer is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. He's authored several books, including Skeleton in God's Closet and In the Fullness of Time. We're talking with him about a forthcoming Discovery Channel documentary called The Lost Tomb of Jesus, produced by famous Titanic documentary and filmmaker James Cameron. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. If one had the means, then, I would assume, to go around poking into every cave or every tomb that may be discovered or undiscovered, you're going to find a lot of Josephs, a lot of Jesuses, a lot of Marys, a lot of Judas. Those names are going to be rather common. If you find those names at all, Dr.
You find the names repeatedly. Absolutely. Though those very names show up all over the place.
So if someone is sitting around the water cooler with their coworkers this afternoon, and one of those coworkers approaches and say, hey, I know that you're a Christian. Did you hear that James Cameron found the body of Jesus? And there goes your whole faith out the window. How should they respond?
Well, just probably by laughing to point out the premise is ridiculous. The trouble is this, guy, Todd, you're going to find that the great unlettered masses out there, you know, are going to hear, uh-oh, DNA, uh-oh, Jesus, uh-oh, tomb, and they're going to put it all together and say they've proved by DNA that Jesus' body's been discovered. And it's ridiculous. And this is what worries me, because even a novel like The Da Vinci Code, the National Geographic checked out the Canadian readers, and they found out that one-third of the readers in Canada thought this was all true. And so this is the thing that worries me. The common people are going to hear about this and suddenly say, uh-oh, there does go Christianity. There it goes, because it believes in the resurrection. It can't have a body left over.
And this documentary has yet to air on the Discovery Channel. What do you expect after it makes its premiere?
Probably have a good readership, viewership, I would think. And then after that, of course, the debate will continue.
You had mentioned your book, Skeleton in God's Closet. If you would, for those of you who aren't familiar with that novel that you wrote, It is uncanny, the coincidence of circumstances here. Just give us your synopsis of your version of this story.
Well, basically, I have bones purporting to be those of Jesus discovered in the course of an archaeological dig, I think with a lot more conviction than this thing. You have manuscripts attached to it, and therefore the whole world, you know, wonders, is this true or not? And so it's a thriller. A theological thriller, and it ends okay. By the way, don't worry about that.
So it does not end with James Cameron standing up on national cable television saying that Jesus has not been raised.
Right, exactly.
Glad to hear that. What can we do to get you on Larry King Live to talk about this documentary on the Lost Tomb of Jesus?
Well, I'd love to. I'd love to face Cameron directly. Believe me, and also Simcha Jakubovici.
I hope someday we can see that. Dr. Paul Meyer, professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. Several books, one in which you will find an uncanny resemblance to the news of the day with a much better outcome, called Skeleton in God's Closet. He also wrote In the Fullness of Time. Dr. Meyer, thank you so much for your time.
Fun being with you. All the best, Todd.
All right. Thank you. For the next 15 minutes of the program, we've got audio open lines for your questions and your comments. Before, earlier in the program, we had heard about Jerry Falwell's sermon at Thomas Road Baptist Church where he was decrying the evils of the myth of global warming. There's another famous preacher this weekend in Detroit. This one, not a Christian preacher, but in fact, Louis Farrakhan, who until very recently was the leader of the Nation of Islam. Here's the story from the Associated Press on his final address.
Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan used his final major speech to call for religious unity in America.
Christians and Muslims, we have to break down these artificial divisions that divide us and come together as a family.
He has led the Nation of Islam since the late 1970s, and his rhetoric has enraged many at times. He once called Judaism a gutter religion, and he suggested the CIA was using crack cocaine to enslave blacks. The 73-year-old has been fighting cancer, and he used this appearance in Detroit at the movement's three-day convention to say goodbye.
My time is up. The final call can't last forever.
Farrakhan, though, did still have some sharp words, and he directed many of them at both the White House and Congress.
What should they do about a man lying to the American people? Deceiving the members of Congress, prosecuting an unjust war. Is that not only reason to impeach him, but to set down his whole administration? So you Democrats, stop pussyfooting around with the Republicans. Do what the people voted that you should do. Make a change in this world.
While this was billed as his last major speech, it was also his first since ceding leadership of the movement last year because of illness. Carlotta Bradley, The Associated Press.
They do make odd bookends, don't they? Jerry Falwell on one side, the right side of Christianity, and then you have Louis Farrakhan on the other side, kind of the left side of Islam or the Nation of Islam. I found it interesting that he starts out by calling for religious unity, and ends by talking about political division, or calling for political division. When in fact, if there's anything that Christians, Muslims, and Jews can agree on, it might be the politics rather than the religion. The things that truly divide Christians, Muslims, and Jews are the theological issues. There really can be no unity, not religious unity, between Christians, Muslims, and Jews, as long as they're all worshiping gods of their own, different gods. But in the realm of politics, we actually could get together on some issues. So Louis Farrakhan appears to have it all completely and utterly backwards. What I'm anxious to see is who can fill his shoes. He has been the face and the personality and the voice of the Nation of Islam for all these years. Who will follow him, and can they fill his rhetorical shoes? He is a compelling speaker. As vile as many of the things he has to say, and as wrong as many of the things he has to say are, he is compelling to listen to. Another very compelling speaker until recently was Pastor Ted Haggard. He was president of the National Association of Evangelicals, and right around election time, there was a series of very shocking revelations made about Ted Haggard consorting with the male prostitute. Here's an update on Ted Haggard's situation and his former church, New Life in Colorado Springs.
Ted Haggard used to be the head of the National Association of Evangelicals. He was also pastor of the 14,000-member New Life Church in Colorado Springs. But that all ended in November, after a male prostitute revealed that Haggard was a regular customer. Months later, the members of New Life Church are still struggling to get up after Haggard's fall. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
In the end, it was Haggard's own opposition to gay marriage that prompted a male prostitute in Denver to reveal the Reverend's secret life. Within a few days, Haggard was fired and whisked off to Arizona for intensive counseling. Except for a few open letters to the church, Haggard has remained silent. More than 3 months later, the pain hasn't yet passed for some members of his congregation. Gwen Cordova is waiting for Sunday services to begin.
I love Pastor Ted. I am sad that I'm not going to see him, or I miss him. As a church, it's not about a man, it's about God. It just shows to me that we're all human.
In the church lobby, Michelle Fallentine says it was difficult to explain to her children what happened.
With Braden, he is 10 years old, and with him, I just explained that there were things going on in the church. The pastor had made some mistakes. You know, we all make mistakes.
Valentine says her 12-year-old son needed more information. She assumed kids at school would talk about what Haggard had done.
And so I wanted to explain to him, we don't know if Pastor Ted is a homosexual, but he chose to do things that, you know, were homosexual behaviors. He has a wife and kids. He loves them. But this was something that he was struggling with in his life. We all have different things we struggle with. So that's kind of where I went with him.
As the crowd quiets down, the music in the auditorium begins to roar. There's a band, complete with fog in the background, a light show, and down near the stage, something resembling a mosh pit. One of the key pastors who investigated Haggard's behavior delivered the sermon last Sunday. Larry Stockstill has his own megachurch in Louisiana. He said there was evidence of sordid conversations, overt suggestions, and relationships the church doesn't approve of.
These findings established a pattern of behavior that culminated in the final relationship in which Ted was, as a matter of grace, caught.
The church will pay Haggard's $130,000 salary through 2007. In exchange, Haggard and his family will move from Colorado Springs.
You know that Ted had an enormous personality. As hard as this action appears, it is considered an unanimous judgment of the restorers and overseers that Ted's presence is so large and his wrongful conduct was so tangled that this church and its leadership would become distracted by his continuing presence.
Stockstill wrapped up by addressing the big question any church faces when there's a leadership crisis: will it stay together?
I feel an anointing of unity, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against this church. Shout hallelujah!
One big test for the congregation came a few weeks back when Haggard's accuser, Mike Jones, showed up on Sunday morning. Jones says he was gathering material for a book. The former prostitute said he was greeted warmly and was thanked for exposing Haggard. Church member Landon Arnold echoes that sentiment.
We should be grateful to him for what he did, to some extent. He revealed a flaw in our system. He revealed a flaw in one of our members. I believe as a body of believers, we're grateful for that because he has made us stronger.
That strength will be tested in coming months as New Life Church searches for a senior pastor. That process is expected to take most of the year. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
Couple thoughts on that. As I'm listening to National Public Radio, go back over some of the stuff about Ted Haggard and then also update the situation. What struck me the most there, several things struck me, but what struck me the most there was the comments of the young man near the end where He's appreciative to the male prostitute because he, quote, revealed a flaw in our system. He revealed a flaw in our membership. And that by revealing that flaw, the congregation was able to eliminate that flaw. And now he says, as a congregation, they're stronger. Why should it take a male prostitute's revelations about your pastor to demonstrate to the congregation that the pastor is a sinner? Should it take something like that for someone, anyone, perhaps a male prostitute, to reveal a flaw in the system? Isn't that what the church is supposed to be doing every Sunday? Pastor and people admitting to the fact that there's not just a flaw in the system, that all of, I mean, it's not just a flaw, it's sin. What I do notice, and did you notice it? Whether it was the fill-in pastor describing Haggard's present situation, or whether it was the parishioners reflecting upon losing their longtime pastor, or someone saying it's good because it revealed a flaw in the system, the one word that did not get mentioned was sin. Now, I know they believe in sin there, but apparently the word is not a big part of the vocabulary. Is your church built around your pastor and his personality? Think about that. Just, it doesn't have to be a male prostitute outing your pastor. But think about it. The congregation that you go to, if your pastor left, would you be like Haggard's parishioners are to a greater extent? It's just not the same. It's not the same with they can do the praise band, they can have the mosh pit. But it's just not the same without Pastor Haggard. How will we ever replace him? He's such a big personality that even the reconcilers or the, redeemers or and the elders of the church decided that he can't even live in Colorado Springs anymore. The stipulation upon them continuing to pay his salary through the end of this year is that he move away. So much is the church built around the personality of Ted Haggard. They wouldn't be able to move on without him. See, here's the danger. It can be a small church, it could be a big church. Doesn't make any difference. When the church is built and formed around the pastor and his personality, his leadership skills, his charisma, he may be his talent. When it's built around that, you have built your church around a man. There's a term of art for that. It's called the cult of personality. Now, there's nothing wrong with having a talented pastor with charisma and with leadership skills. Nothing wrong with any of that. It's just that you can't build your church around it. That is not the foundation upon which Jesus' promise is attached. The gates of hell shall not prevail against it. The gates of hell does not prevail against the church, not because the pastor's skilled and charismatic and a great communicator and very likable. The gates of hell don't prevail against any church, the church, because the foundation of that church is not the pastor, but Jesus Christ crucified and risen from the dead for sinners. We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Dr. Carl Fekincher of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on good reasons to become a pastor.
Before I went to the seminary, I worked in business for a number of years, and I enjoyed very much what I was doing, but I realized that the aspects of my jobs that I appreciated the most certainly were the opportunities to be helpful and encouraging and supportive of the people who worked with me. And it was quite clear to me, without any question, that the way I could be most helpful to them was sharing the good news of Jesus Christ, their Savior. And I realized that if I became a pastor, that would be what I'd do all the time, and I would never be restricted in any way in what I could say. The help that I could bring to people that I cared about would be the help that was not just for today or tomorrow, but eternal.
To schedule an on-campus visit at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, call 1-800-481-2155.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. If you're politically active, beware. Representative Henry Waxman of California has proposed a bill that hangs your rights to petition the government in the balance. His measure, the Executive Branch Reform Act, would require administration officials to report any contact they have with the public if policy actions are discussed. Steve Jordahl reports it's being called the worst bill ever to land in Washington.
Under this legislation, if you participated last year in Focus on the Family's effort to convince President Bush to veto expanded stem cell research, your name would go on a public list as a Focus lobbyist. That could cause some problems if your employer has something against politicking or Focus on the Family. Former Reagan White House official Gary Bauer calls it the worst idea he's ever seen in Washington.
This bill would have a chilling effect on all of that, would make, I think, any president and his staff more isolated than they already are. I served for 8 years in the executive branch of government, and it was very clear to me that one of the most important things those of us in that branch of government could do was talk to people.
The chill would work both ways, according to Douglas Johnson of National Right to Life.
The officials are simply going to be especially reluctant to communicate with groups that represent controversial causes because they're going to know that the liberal news media is going to try to make something of that.
Amanda Banks of Focus on the Family Action calls the bill a sleight of hand.
This is just also an attempt to take away the ethics reform that's needed in Congress and divert the attention to the executive branch.
Waxman's bill is waiting for a scheduled vote on the House floor. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
The bill, co-sponsored by Virginia Republican Tom Davis, says any significant contact, broadly defined as any oral or written communication, must be reported by upper-level administration officials. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Here at AM 850 KFUO, it's our privilege to salute our day sponsors on this Monday, February 26th, 2007, the family of Vernon Kirkhoff. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in loving memory of Vernon Kirkhoff. Once again, we say thank you to our AM 850 KFUO day sponsors, the family of Vernon Kirkhoff, all of Collinsville, Illinois. Concordia Publishing House and Issues Etc. are pleased to offer our Book of the Month for February, titled A Seminary in Crisis. It's a history book that you won't be able to put down. A Seminary in Crisis tells the story about the battle for the Bible in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in the early 1970s. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The book, A Seminary in Crisis.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Wesley Smith is our guest. We're going to be, you might have seen this in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It's an Associated Press story. Potential of less controversial adult stem cells question. Well, for a long time, we've been talking here on Issues Etc. with various guests, including Wesley Smith, about the potential for adult stem cells over against those of embryonic stem cells, which is more fruitful. And here is this story saying perhaps not as fruitful as everyone thinks. Wesley Smith is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's author of several books, including his latest Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. Wesley, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. I'm here in California, and believe it or not, we're having a monsoon. It's quite remarkable.
What is a monsoon? I thought they were typhoons over on that coast.
No, it's like it's a huge rainstorm, and so I'm glad I'm talking to you in the Sun Belt.
Well, yes, actually, by comparison, we are the Sun Belt, although we're colder than it'll ever get for you guys. Well, I don't know, maybe not in Northern California. It might get this cold out there.
Only in the mountains.
You read the story from the Associated Press, and in fact, you've reacted to it.
Oh, of
as
course.
Well.
It's so much ado about very little. And it demonstrates to me quite vividly the agenda, particularly in Missouri media, but throughout the nation, to try to destroy anything other than an embryonic stem cell boost. What happened in this situation was there was an honest mistake by this Catherine Verfalle, who had back, oh gosh, 4 or 5 years ago, apparently isolated a form of bone marrow stem cell that could be what is called pluripotent. That is, it might be able to transform into almost every kind of tissue in the body, which is supposedly the gold standard for stem cells, which I think is highly overrated, but I'm not a scientist, and we can get into that if you'd like. It turns out that in two separate papers, she inadvertently had reproduced the same data to support her thesis, and it didn't have to do with what the cells could do, but the process of isolating the cells. And so what you had here was, and it was a mistake, a form, in a very arcane mistake, that is, she had inadvertently, so I'm saying misrepresented, but that's not the right word, that she had inadvertently presented two separate papers showing a way to isolate the cells, and that's apparently where the mistake is. She says that the cells themselves still do what it is that she claimed they could do, and this was all in mouse studies. This has nothing to do with the human trials that we've been discussing on your show and others have with other forms of adult stem cells. You know, we've had olfactory stem cells are in human trials now to treat spinal cord injury and paralysis, and peer-reviewed studies have shown that they have restored feeling. You have trials ongoing with bone marrow stem cells to treat multiple sclerosis, and while it cannot cure multiple sclerosis in the human trials so far, it does appear to be able to stop it from getting worse, that is, from progressing. You have bone marrow, blood, and various other kinds of adult stem cells or umbilical cord blood stem cells used in trying to treat heart disease, and there's, in fact, a new human trial just began using fat stem cells. So all of the issues of human trials that we've discussed on your show have nothing whatsoever to do with this Verfali study, which had to do with mouse adult stem cells in the bone marrow, and the question would be whether our bone marrow has those kinds of stem cells. But, of course, the media blew the attack on this adult stem cell all out of proportion as a way of undermining the potential for adult stem cell research, because that potential is really beginning to impact the debate on embryonic stem cell research.
So why is the press and the embryonic stem cell research community, why aren't they as vigilant when it comes to the research being done on embryonic stem cells, which are routinely touted by the press and the embryonic stem cell community as holding promise just days away? We're going to be curing Parkinson's or cancer or all these kind of things with embryonic stem cells.
You mean, Todd, you've noticed that there's a different level of skepticism depending on which side they're reporting on?
Yeah, a little double standard.
You notice the double standard? I can't believe you noticed that. It's so subtle. All I can say is I think there are two kinds of three kinds of reporting, let's say, that's going on. And I have particular mind with the Post-Dispatch and the Kansas City Star. They are biased, flat-out biased. I've had discussions with a reporter who I won't name at the Kansas City Star, showing him, for example, proof that somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning creates an embryo, and he just won't believe it, and he won't report that it does. Even though in the UK, in England, where that is cloning is not as controversial, they routinely admit that it creates an embryo. But it's controversial in Missouri, so we can't call it an embryo. We say it's just a bunch of cells or some other kind of rot. There's biased media. There is boosterism media. That is, I think some of the science reporters in particular believe that their job is to promote science rather than just report on it, and so you get a lot of boosterism. Then there's ignorant media. That is, you'll get a general reporter who's just a general assignment reporter. I don't mean just in a denigrating sense, but he's a general or she's a general assignment reporter. So one day they're covering a fire, the next day they're covering Governor Blunt giving a speech, and the next day perhaps they're covering a stem cell story. That is, they don't have institutional memory. So they're called out to, let's say, cover an adult stem cell or an embryonic stem cell experiment. And they'll go to the scientists, who frankly are corrupting science by their inaccurate statements to the press and others and to legislators, and the scientists will say, well, this embryonic has the best hope. They can become any tissue in the body. And they won't think to ask, well, have they done that yet? Have they turned embryonic stem cells into any tissue in the body on command? And the answer is no. But they don't even know enough about the story because there are general reporters to ask the question. So you find also that that many in the media will decide who they like and who they don't like in terms of the pro-life issue. So the anti-embryonic stem cell, anti-human cloning side is deemed to be the religious right. Most reporters loathe the religious right. And so they will take what they say with a whole lot of skepticism, and I think they should. They should take what anybody says with skepticism. But they're also caught up in terms of what I call expertitis. That is, they get so smitten with the PhDs after the name of some of these science advocates who are more advocates than scientists, and they will swallow what they say without any skepticism, and often what they're being told is just flat-out wrong.
We were told here in Missouri in the big run-up to the November election where Amendment 2 passed that made legal at the state level everything that was legal at the federal level regarding embryonic stem cell research and human cloning. We were told by the advocates...
No, they wouldn't admit it was human cloning, Todd.
Right, exactly. I'm inserting that myself. The advocates of embryonic stem cell research and cloning for even though they would not admit that, of course, cloning for disruptive biomedical research said, look, we're in favor of all stem cell research. We've got nothing against adult stem cells as a source and as an avenue. We just want to be able to pursue all avenues. Do you expect those advocates to make much of this honest mistake on the part of this?
Yeah, of course.
Adult stem cell research.
They will say that, but what they really are upset about is the implication in President Bush's funding policy and also the strong implication in the attempts there in Missouri, for which I've testified, as you know, to outlaw all human cloning, that there is an ethical issue with creating and destroying embryos. What Amendment 2 has done is created a constitutional right in Missouri, which used to be called the Show Me State and is now being called the Clone Me State, to engage in somatic cell nuclear transfer with humans. That is the cloning process that created Dolly the Sheep, the purpose for which, at least initially and under the Amendment 2, will be not to create to gestate through to birth and have a baby, but to be destroyed in research. So what Amendment 2 has done has turned nascent human life, cloned human life, into a mere natural resource, a corn crop, if you will, to be sown and harvested. That has profound ethical implications because rather than being a subject, this nascent form of human life is being turned into an object, a thing, a resource. And this is not a science debate, but a very important ethical and moral debate. And so when the scientists say we want all forms of research, well, of course they do. But what they also want is basically anything goes. As an example, the National Academy of Sciences has said, which is a very prestigious national science organization with affiliations with the government, has said that under their ethical guidelines, scientists should not only be able to create cloned human embryos, but fertilized human embryos for use in research. Now, back in 2001, when this embryonic stem cell research was really a big fight with President Bush, and before, some of these same scientists were saying, we never want to create human life for research. We only want those leftover embryos. That's yesterday's argument. They're well past that. And once they're able to reliably create cloned human embryos, which they can't yet because they don't know how, eventually they're going to say, well, now we need to gestate them longer because there's cures to be had, there's scientific information to be gained, and they're not going to be born anyway, so they're not really human. It is a corruption of science to say that an embryo isn't really human because of what you're going to do with it. An embryo is really human because of what it is. And that science doesn't depend on a narrative to determine what something is. It depends on whether it is an organism or not. A human embryo is a human organism. It is a nascent human being. That is basically true in every embryology textbook I've ever seen, and that definition is being shifted among some science and even in some science books, not for science purposes, but for political purposes, which is actually to corrupt science itself. So the corruptors of science are not those people who have an ethical objection to some of this research. They are some of the very advocates who are saying that in the name of science, We have to wipe this ethical objection off the map. Mr. Stowers, who spent, what was it, $30 million of his own money to buy his own constitutional amendment there in Missouri, and they're willing to use junk biology to get there, which has the very deep, ironic effect of literally undermining and corrupting the basis of science.
I want your reaction to one of the paragraphs from the Associated Press story. It says, and just evaluate this for its truthfulness, as far as you can tell from what you know of the subject. So far, only embryonic stem cells, which are commonly taken from embryos at an early stage of development, are known to hold such regenerative promise.
Well, they haven't done it yet. You cannot say that they hold this promise when it hasn't been done. You can say scientists believe they hold this promise, or in theory they hold this promise, but you cannot say they do hold this promise.
It says they are known to hold such regenerative promise.
They are not known to. That's not true. You cannot say they are known to until the actual experiments work and are replicated, which has not occurred.
So I could walk in with a peanut and say, I think I can cure cancer with this peanut. But if I were to say, I know that this peanut holds regenerative promise, I'm simply making stuff up.
Well, I think you're overstating with the peanut for effect, obviously, but that's essentially correct. Obviously, you wouldn't go in and say this peanut can cure cancer because there isn't even a theory why that would happen. They can say that, in theory, an embryonic stem cell can be transformed into every tissue in the body because that's precisely what happens in a living embryo. They cannot say they know it can be done outside of that embryo itself, or that these things can actually cure because it hasn't been done yet. Neither of have been done. Right now, when you take an embryonic stem cell and you try to transform it into a different type of tissue, what you get generally is a dish full of different kinds of cells. You might get heart cells, bone cells, blood cells, this kind of thing, and you have to tweeze out the kind you want. That is not going to cut it when it comes to this kind of research. So what they are stating in that sentence you read to me is not true.
I'm going to come back to that sentence in just a moment for more reaction from Wesley Smith. We're talking about a new study that review of a study that questions the effectiveness of adult stem cell research. Wesley Smith is our guest, a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute. Our phone numbers, as we talk with Wesley live this Monday, February the 26th, it is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio as well, issuesetc@kfuo.org. In the next hour, we're going to discuss the invocation of saints with Dr. Kent Burrison of Concordia Seminary. Okay, back to the sentence, and I want, just tell me if I'm picking at too many nits, Wesley. So far, only embryonic stem cells, which are commonly taken from embryos at an early stage of development.
Always taken.
What is this commonly taken? I'm not an expert in the dictionary, but look, that either means that it's sometimes, but not always, taken from embryos, or that it happens so often that it's just a common occurrence.
Well, it's not that common in the sense that it's still very difficult to derive these embryonic stem cells. They may be referring to that the allegation that if the stem cell is taken from a somatic cell nuclear transfer created embryo, it's not really an embryo. That may be what they're saying. But I think they're just basically using language that, again, is intended to dilute the ethical implications of this research.
All right, then the other thing that concerned me here, Wesley, is it says taken from embryos at an early stage of development, comma, then it moves on to talk about the stem cells themselves, as though the embryo just jumps in his car and drives away happily. It does not...
It doesn't say that the embryo is destroyed in the process.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is precisely what makes the research so controversial.
It avoids the exact objection that people like you and people like me have to this procedure.
You know, if it happened on occasion, you'd think it was inadvertent, but it is done repeatedly and systematically. It is part of a campaign, I believe, from big biotech to try to mute people's objections to this. And I think that when it comes to reporting this issue, most of the media plays Ginger Rogers to big biotech's Fred Astaire. And what's so ironic is if Big Oil did something like that, or Big Pharma did something like that, or the Bush administration did something like that, the same media people who just quietly and meekly report it the way Big Biotech wants would be screaming bloody murder about how they're trying to twist, convolute, and obscure the truth.
Well, here's another one before I go to the phones real quick. And this has to do with, it actually is in this story at one point, but I've noticed the use of the term embryo without reference to what kind of embryo it is. In fact, in stories I've read, when it's a mouse embryo, it is routinely reported in the press that it's a mouse embryo. But for some reason, when it's a human embryo, the word human is omitted. You know, they took these cells from mouse embryos and did mouse studies, yada, yada, yada. But then when the subject turns to taking these cells from human embryos, the word human isn't in there.
Well, maybe it's implied. I don't know. I've been following the media bias on this, as you know, for many years, and I report on it regularly at my blog, Secondhand Smoke. And it's just the way life is. And what we have to understand is that for us to get our message out on the ethical implications of this research, that the media is like gravity and we're like rocket scientists trying to get a rocket into orbit. It's something we just have to go through. It's just part of the environment, and we have to expose it when we can, but we also cannot let it get us down. And that's why shows like yours are so important, Todd, the alternative media in which actual facts can often be presented that will not appear in the mainstream press is important so that at least there is a way to get some of this information beyond what I call the news blockade.
Let's talk with Mike in Kansas City. Mike, thank you for being patient. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, thank you, Pastor Todd.
Hi, Mike.
I'm a supporter of Issues, Etc. I'm a supporter of Issues, Etc., and I really hope other people would consider doing the same because, once again, this is a hugely educational topic you've got here. My problem has been talking to people concerning this issue in that I find it very difficult to explain exactly what SCNT is.
Let me describe that very quickly, because it's easy actually to describe. Let's say you wanted to clone me.
Uh-huh.
And why you'd want to do that is a good question, but we'll move on. Somatic cell nuclear transfer merely means, somatic means body. Mm-hmm. Cell, we all know what a cell is. So it's a body cell nuclear, that is the nucleus of these cells, transfer. What you do is you take an egg cell, you take out the nucleus. We all know that every cell has a nucleus. You then, if you were going to try to clone me, take one of my body cells, say a skin cell. You take out the nucleus. You put it where the egg cell used to be. You now have a genetically modified egg, and what's remarkable and important about that is that the nucleus will have 46 chromosomes, which is the full human complement. The cloner will then try to fuse the nucleus and the rest of the egg. Just zap it with electricity, we'll say.
So kind of a Frankensteinian sort of thing.
Yeah, it's called asexual reproduction.
If
the zapping works, a new embryo comes into being because the egg perceives it's almost as if it had been fertilized. Because there are 46 chromosomes. You know, when a sperm and egg come together, 23 and 23 equals 46, right? So the properties of the egg transform. The egg disappears, the sperm disappears, and a new one-celled embryo called a zygote comes into being. The same thing happens in somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning. You end up with a one-celled new individual embryo with the full 46 chromosomes. That embryo would be a virtual identical twin of me.
Okay,
it would not be me. It would be an identical twin of me. It would be a separate individual human organism.
Mike, a quick question, because our time is very short.
Sure. Well, it's just that. Let me see if I understand. Thank you for that. Let me see if I understand this correctly, then. The female egg, the nucleus is removed, and in the female egg, the nucleus is what contains the female set of chromosomes.
Right.
So the nucleus, or the egg, basically becomes an incubator, and then the cell is inserted into the egg with only one set of chromosomes, and that is why that is why it grows to be an exact clone of whatever cell you insert within the egg. Is that correct?
That's basically correct, yeah.
Thank you very much, Mike. It's a good question. It's a very good basic question. So, look, There's Mike. He's a regular listener, and he's heard this explanation many times. You talked about the hurdle that is media coverage on this issue. How big is the hurdle, realistically, for the average person, the average listener, on not only understanding, but then being able to articulately argue against the kind of stuff that we're reading from the Associated Press this week?
I don't think it's a big hurdle in that sense, because there are plenty of other areas to gain information. My blog, my books, what David Prentice has been doing with the Family Research Council. There's a website called Do No Harm, stemcellresearch.org, I believe. So there are plenty of places to get this information if one wishes to look. You're just not going to find it accurately in terms of science or in terms of the ethics, actually, presented in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch or the Kansas City Star or the New York Times.
Real quick question with only 30 seconds. I read in the paper a couple of weeks ago that some of that money that California voters had inadvertently voted in favor of embryonic stem cell research is actually starting to flow in that state. Is that true, Wesley?
Well, yes and no. The Governor Schwarzenegger has borrowed $150 million to allow these grants to be issued, because the money itself, we're borrowing, as you know, $3 billion over 10 years to pay for this, is still held up in the courts. But the first grant money has been issued.
Wesley Smith is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia-Assisted Suicide. He's got a blog and a website. You really want to visit this. It is the best resource for finding out the facts on issues bioethical. That's why he's a guest on this program. WesleyJSmith.com, www.WesleyJSmith.com. He's author of several books, including his latest, A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. Wesley, thank you again for your time.
Thanks, Todd. Always good talking to you and your audience.
Thank you. When we come back from this break, we've got third hour of the program ahead. Dr. Kent Burrison will be our guest to talk about the invocation of the saints. How do we deal with those, or do we deal with those who have gone on to be with Christ and await the resurrection? One of the primary missions of Issues, Etc., as you probably heard many times if you're a regular listener, is equipping the priesthood of all believers. What does that mean? That means that where you are at your place in life right now, it is very difficult for you to deal with all the issues that come at you, either from the Associated Press or the St. Louis Post-Dispatch or documentaries being put on the tomb of Jesus. That's why we are here, to help equip you to respond to these things as they happen. Think about it. This story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch came out just Sunday, and we're talking about it on Monday. It was just last week that, in fact, over the weekend, that James Cameron decided he was going to offer his Discovery Channel documentary on the tomb of Jesus. We're talking about it on Monday. We respond immediate with expert guests like Wesley Smith and Dr. Paul Meyer. Please help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, Etc., by making a tax-deductible gift during the season of Lent and Easter. Now, as a way of thanking you for this gift, and no gift is too small, in thanks for any gift between now and the end of the Easter season, we're going to send you a CD of interviews on the Passion and the Resurrection of Christ with Dr. Arthur Just and Dr. Norman Nagel. You can donate online, our website, issuesetc.org. You can also call our resource line. It's 1-800-737-0172, Equipping the Priesthood of All Believers, 1-800-737-0172. We'll be right back.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.